Well, this week we find ourselves back in Matthew chapter 8. We're going to complete the chapter today, God willing. And we're going to pick it up in verse 18. Now, when you read this last half of the chapter, it seems like unrelated stories. You've got the story of the two men who come to Yeshua saying, "We want to follow you." And one says, "I'll follow you anywhere." Another one says, "I'll follow you, but let me go bury my father first." And Yeshua just kind of brushes them off and says, maybe this isn't for you. And then you've got the story of the storm at sea. And Yeshua is asleep in the boat. They wake him up, he calms the storm. And then you've got the story of the demoniac who had thousands of demons in him, apparently. And Yeshua allows the demons to leave the man and go into the pigs. They jump into the lake and drown. Seemingly three unrelated stories, but they're all connected. Because all three of these stories happen in the context of a boat voyage. And the first verse, in verse 18, says, "When Yeshua saw the large crowd of people around him, he gave instruction to cross from there to the other side of the sea." So he's trying to start a voyage to go to the other side of the sea, but then interruptions happen. And I wish I had the quote. I was sitting in prayer service, and I thought, I should have brought that quote by C.S. Lewis, because I know I'll mess it up. But C.S. Lewis talks about the interruptions. What we have what we think is our normal life. Then interruptions come. And he says, that's the wrong way to think. He says, the interruptions are your real life, the life God is sending you every moment. And the thing that you think is your real life is a fantasy. We need to grab hold of that thought. Because I know my life is filled with interruptions, and I can either resent them because they're interfering with my life, or realize God is sending me my life one moment at a time. And the interruptions are my life. So Yeshua wants to get in the boat. Now, something important about this verse. Yeshua did not like crowds. He saw the crowds, and then he gives his disciples instructions, let's go to the other side. Let's go away from here. I want you to think about that for a moment. Because generally, in the faith community, we want as big a crowd as we can get. But that's worldly thinking. If you stop and think about it, very few good things ever happen in crowds. God is not interested in crowds. And when you hear someone say in a faith community, let's try to get as many people to fill in the blank, I want you to stop and think that those words and that counsel probably didn't come from God. Let's try to get as many people as possible to come to our concert. Let's get as many people as we can to join this program. Let's get as many people as we can to go on this missions trip. Whenever you hear those words, as many people as we can, it's probably not God's counsel. And when I see how God operates, he operates through very small, almost insignificant ways with individuals. In fact, this whole chapter is Yeshua's attempt to go talk to one man. Everything from this verse to the end is his attempt to go and talk to one man. But then the interruptions come. But he embraces them, he deals with them, and they're there for our instruction. And I think that by the time we get to the end of the chapter, you'll see that all three of these stories are dealing with the internals of a human being. So he says, get in the boat, go to the other side. But there's an interruption. Verse 19, one of the scholars approached him and said to him, "Rabbi, let me follow you wherever you go. I'll go wherever you want. Wherever you go, I'll be right there with you." Yeshua said to him, "The foxes have holes and the birds of the sky have nests. So the man has not a place to rest his head." Then it says, a different man from among the disciples said to him, "Master, permit me and I will go first to bury my father." Yeshua said to him, "Follow me. Leave the dead to bury their dead." Now, we're always looking for menorah patterns. And we might have discussed this briefly a few chapters ago. But this forms a perfect menorah pattern with a previous passage. If you go back to Matthew chapter 4, you see two encounters, but this time instead of people volunteering to follow Yeshua, you see Yeshua going and just calling people and say, follow me. In Matthew 4, 18 to 22, you find Yeshua coming to Peter and Andrew, who are brothers. They're fishermen. They're being productive. They're working in their boat. There's a pair of them, and he says, follow me. And they immediately left the boat and followed him. Then immediately after that, you see him calling James and John. They're again being productive. They're in their father's boat, and they're mending the nets. Yeshua says, follow me. They leave the boat and their father, it says, and they follow him. Now over here in the right column in Matthew 8, we see men volunteering to follow Yeshua. But a couple of things I want us to see now that we lay these side by side is first of all this. In Matthew 4, when Yeshua called these men, we have their names and they're in pairs. But the people volunteering to follow Yeshua, we have no names and they're coming individually. And then he kind of discourages them. Why is this? Well, you look in the first part of chapter 8. What has happened? Yeshua's healed a leper. He's healed the centurion's servant. He has healed Peter's mother-in-law. And then all the people of Capernaum come with all the demon-possessed. He delivers all of them. And they bring all their sick and he heals them all. All of a sudden, Yeshua is very popular and there's a crowd around. And people are wanting to join up. Back when he calls Peter and Andrew, James and John, there's no crowds. He's just a man, a rabbi. He has a reputation. He's done a few things. But he hasn't reached this position of popularity that he has now in the middle of chapter 8. And there are always people who want to kind of clam on. You know, they want to just join the group, join the crowd, be in the inner circle. And these are the ones where we have to be very careful. Now, think about what this scribe here is saying. He's saying, Rabbi, let me follow you. I'll follow you wherever you go. Well, then if he's going to follow Yeshua wherever he goes, it makes no difference if Yeshua doesn't have a home or not. But Yeshua enlightens him, says, listen here. Foxes have holes. They have a place to go to sleep during the day. And the birds of the air have nests. They have a place to go and sleep at night. I have no place to lay my head. Yeshua never owned a home. So apparently, Yeshua knew something the disciple didn't. This disciple, the scribe must have imagined what it would be like to follow Yeshua, and Yeshua is saying, it's not what you think. And I think too many times we think we know what following God is going to be like, and we don't. And I know Peter and Andrew didn't know what it was going to be like. And James and John didn't either. But God knew it was in them. Yeshua knew it was in their hearts and he called them. But the moment we think we know what following God's going to be like, either you're not following God or you're in for a big surprise. A huge surprise. And so he enlightens him and says, it's not what you think it is. James and John are in their father's boat, mending nets with their father. But over here in Matthew 8, there's a disciple. I wonder if that term is being used loosely here, because a disciple puts his rabbi first, even before his earthly father. But this so-called disciple said, I need to go bury my father. Now, if the father's dead, he's been buried, because they would bury a person within 24 hours of their death. But there's two other possibilities here. One is the father isn't dead yet, but he's old, he's sick, he's close to dying. And this young man is saying, listen, I'll follow you, but my father's about to die. Let me wait till he dies, and then I will bury him, and then I'll be right there with you. Or it could be that his father had died a year before. And what would happen is that you know, the tombs, what they would use the tombs for, you take the body and prepare it, put it in the tomb. 1 year later to the day, you come back to the tomb. By that time, the flesh is all gone off the bones. You collect the bones, put them in an ossuary, which is a small stone box, and then you put the box in another part, and then the tomb is ready for another dead body to come in. The tombs back then were actually a way to recycle dead bodies. So when it talks about Yeshua, and they put him in a new tomb where no one had ever been laid before, it means it had never been used to recycle a body. So it could be this man's father had died a year before, and it's almost time to go back, collect his bones, put them in a box. This is a very sacred moment. It was a way of honoring the father, and a year later you kind of bury the father again. You inter his bones a second time. So that's the possibility. But Yeshua says, no, there are other people who can do that. If you're going to be my disciple, I must come first before mom and dad, brother, sister, son, daughter. In fact, Yeshua says in Matthew 10:37, whoever loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And I know of believers who are idolaters. Not of idols of wood and metal, but idols of people. Often it's children. And I have watched people make a wreck of their life of following God because they've idolized a son or a daughter. And as a result, their walk with God is destroyed and their child is destroyed. We need to be very careful of this. The best thing you can do for your child or for any other relatives is let them see you put God first. Children need to see that parents' marriage comes before them. That mom puts daddy before me. That daddy puts mom before me. That they both put God before me. And then that child will have security. Because think of the pressure and the weight you're putting on that child when you let that child think, you are my everything. You are everything for me. You are my life. How's a child supposed to handle that? They can't handle that sort of thing. When you have a couple whose marriage is really shaky, but they're staying together for the sake of the child, picture two adults, a man and woman, playing tug of war, and the child is the rope. The stress that puts on the children is unbelievable. And the child will not be able to articulate what's wrong, but you're going to find a child, a little boy, a little girl, who is filled with stress, with anxiety, with fear, with worry and issues, and they don't even know what they are. Let's set our children free by loving one another and loving God before them. And then we can love them as they should be. But you get those out of order, life's a wreck. It's upside down and it's unscriptural. You know, there's still a lot we could say about that, but we need to move on. You know, Peter, he's the oldest of the disciples. And he pipes up and Mark 10, he pipes up and says, see, we've left everything and followed you. Yeshua said, truly, I say to you, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or lands for my sake and for the gospel, who will not receive 100-fold now in this time houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and lands with persecutions and in the age to come, Chai Olam. You know, we all have family. We all have blood relatives, right? And then we also have spiritual brothers and sisters. You ever find your spiritual brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers and spiritual friends sometimes can be closer than your blood relatives? Don't be surprised. Don't be surprised. And don't feel guilty either. Don't feel guilty either. I want to set you free, all right? You love your parents. You love your brothers and sisters. You love the family God's given you because he's assigned those to you. But don't be surprised if in the heart, in your spirit, there are others you connect with even more. And I can say this because Yeshua himself had a brother. He had several brothers and sisters. James was his brother, and James was not a believer. You'll find some places where James almost mocks him. But after Yeshua's death and resurrection and ascension, James becomes the leader of the faith community in Jerusalem. He becomes a giant of the faith. But during this period of time in Matthew, it was Peter and James and John and others who are much closer to Yeshua than his own flesh and blood. In fact, in one place, his own flesh and blood said, he's crazy. This older brother of ours, he's nuts. So don't be surprised. If flesh and blood breaks your heart, don't feel guilty. Don't feel guilty. All right. Now, they get into a boat. And let's take a look at what a first century fishing boat would look like. There's one. And these boats can be up to about 27 feet long and 7 feet wide. And we know this is what they look like. This is right on the Sea of Galilee. We know this how they look because, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago, the level of the Sea of Galilee dropped so alarmingly that much of the bottom was exposed. And guess what they found? A first century fishing boat. Who knows? Maybe it was one that Yeshua himself would have been in. And this is on display and open to view right up on the northwestern coast of the Sea of Galilee. There's a kibbutz there, and you can go in and you can see this. But while we look at the boat, I have to show you this too. These are boat anchors. So when you see the word anchor in Scripture, don't be thinking this, you know, this thing with a current, like the tattoo on Popeye's forearm. You know, that's not what they had as anchors. What they had were rocks with a hole in them you could put a rope through. And the reason I want you to keep that in mind, because this wonderful verse in Hebrews 6:19 says, we have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain. Instead of a physical boat anchor that you drop in the water, we have an anchor of the soul we cast into the heavens. Our anchor is Yeshua. And what is Yeshua? He is a rock that has been pierced. See? And the people who would have read this in Hebrews, when they thought anchor, they didn't think modern anchor like we do, a rock that has been pierced. And because we have a rock who has been pierced, who is in the heavenlies, he is our anchor. You get the picture? Don't ever forget that picture right there. That may be the most important thing you hear this morning. But we must have a rock anchor in the heavenlies. Now, a word about boats. And, you know, if you're using the Delitzsch Gospels, the Hebrew Gospels, you're going to see this word, ha'aniyah. Ha'aniya, and it's going to be, if you're looking at the Hebrew, verse 23, over in the right-hand page, 23, and you count to the left, first, second, third word, Vayered el Ha'aniya. That word Ha'aniya means the boat. Now, if you just cover up the hay here, just cover that up, then you have the word boat, Aniya, okay? But Ha'aniya means the boat. You got it? There's boat, Aniya. Ha-Aniya means the boat. Now, the reason I bring this up is because the rabbis for centuries have seen something very interesting about this. And this is the same word that's used in the story of Jonah and throughout the Hebrew Scriptures. And the reason I point this out is because these middle three letters, or the first three letters of the word boat, spell the word Ani, which means I. Me. And the Hebrew language, being the language of transcendence, is telling us something. Wherever you see a boat in the Scriptures, it's a picture of you in this world. It's a picture of you in this world. Because you see, for you to survive in this world, you have to have a body. This is your earth suit. And once you step out of your earth suit, you're not in this world anymore. And so being a human being in this body is like being a boat at sea. Sometimes the seas are calm. Sometimes the seas are choppy. And sometimes there's an outright storm at sea. But if you're in a boat in the sea, that is not where you live. It means you're on your way to a destination. And if you're in this world is not your destination. This world is part of your journey to get to your destination. Is that clear? If you're in a boat, you're not at home. And we're all in a boat right now. But think of this when you see, especially in the Gospels, you think of Yeshua. He got into a boat, pushed off a little way from the shore, that addressed the crowds. This is what he wants to do with us. He wants to get into our lives, put a little distance between us and others. You know, not be isolated, but be separate. Okay? And then through us, he can address other people. And when you see Yeshua get into a boat, it's a picture of him getting into you. Make sure you always keep that in mind. One of the things Solomon said, or the most difficult things to understand, is the way of an aniya on the sea. Now, I want you to think about this as well. What is it that pushes a boat through the water? There are three things. First thing it could be is just the waves. And there are some people, and I've done this sometimes, where my life's out of control. Just the waves, the tossing of the waves, just pushes me along. That's always a disaster. But there's another thing. So if what's below you directing your life could be what's above you, could be the wind. You put your sail out, you can let the wind direct you. And sometimes you have to put your oars in the water and you direct to yourself. But you've got sometimes three contrary forces working on your boat. The waves might want to push you that way, the wind push you that way, and you're wanting to go that way. And life can get very confusing. But regardless of whether it's the waves or the wind or the oar, there's one thing you must always, always, always be in control of, and that is the rudder. You must always have the rudder in hand. Because whether people are rowing, or you're using the power of the wind, or the power of the waves, you must have the rudder to direct the ship. And what is the rudder? The tongue. We talked about this a little bit last week, didn't we? What you say will direct your life. And it says in James 3, 3 and 4, if we put bits into the mouths of horses so that they obey us, we guide their whole bodies as well. Look at the ships, the Haniah. Look at the ships also. Though they are so large and are driven by strong winds, they are guided by a very small rudder, wherever the will of the pilot directs. We need to be so cautious and careful of what comes out of our mouths, because what you speak reveals what's in your heart. It reveals what's in your soul. It reveals how you are perceiving things. Now, I'm not one of these name it, claim it people in any way, shape, or form. I hate that theology. But when it comes to spiritual things, we must be very careful and speak the truth always. And I know when I counsel with people, I irritate them to death, because what I'm always listening for them to speak lies. Not that they're trying to deceive me, but the lies that they're believing in their own life. And I say, wait a minute, stop. What you just said isn't true. What do you mean? Say it again. They'll say it. I say, what makes in the world makes you think that is true? Well, I don't know. Maybe it is. No, it's not true. Quit believing that. Don't say that anymore. And all the time we're speaking lies when instead of speaking the truth. And when we speak lies, we perceive the world in a very distorted way. We perceive ourselves in a distorted way. We perceive God in a distorted way. We need to have our minds bathed in the truth of His Word so we see the world around us through truth and see reality as it really is and not just as it appears to be. So, let's move on. Let's pick it up now in chapter 8 and verse 23. So, he finally gets into the boat. He went down to the boat, and his disciples went down with him. There was a great storm on the sea, to the point where the waves would cover the boat. But he was sleeping. Does that remind you of another story? What story does that remind you of? Storm at sea, Jonah. You're supposed to think of Jonah. That's the other half of the menorah pattern here. We have to put these two stories side by side. But let's move on. His disciples approached him and woke him, saying, "Save us, our master, we are perishing." Now, Mark 4:38, in his account, he adds in one little bit of information that's very important. This is what they really say. They say, "Master, don't you care that we're perishing? Don't you care?" You know, there are a lot of dumb questions in the Bible. People ask dumb questions all the time. And yes, there are such things as dumb questions. There are three kinds of questions that I'm aware of. There are wise questions. There are diabolical, wicked questions. These are questions you ask to arouse doubt. These are the questions Satan asks. Has God really said? You know, that sort of thing. And people say, "Well, I'm just asking honest questions." No, they're very dishonest questions sometimes. When a question is asked so it's aroused doubt, that's a wicked and dishonest question. And then they're just dumb questions. Don't you care? You know, how many times in our own hearts we're going through a storm, God seems asleep, and we say, "God, don't you care?" Now maybe we don't say with our mouths, but in our hearts we're thinking, "Does God really care?" Dumb question. And look what he does. He said to them, "Oh, small ones in faith, why are you afraid?" And if you read the other accounts in Mark and Luke, you have to read the words he says there. Very similar, but he rebukes them. He got up, reprimanded the winds and the sea, and there was a great silence. The men were amazed and said, "Who is he then? Who is this man? That even the winds and the sea listen to him." Now, this is a good question. It went from a dumb question to a wise question. But I want you to notice something. He doesn't rebuke the storm out there first. He rebukes the storm in them first. Now think about it. If you're in the boat, your first priority is take care of the storm first, then you can chew me out. God says, no, you got it backwards. The storm in you is the one I need to deal with. This is small potatoes out here. And he rebukes them first. Then he calms the storm. You see the order? First things first. And I think in every one of our lives, we need to get past this thinking, if there's peace around me, then I'll have peace inside. No. God needs to rebuke the storm in your heart, number one, and then he can bring peace out here, number two. But let's compare Jonah and Yeshua. Jonah, his real name is Jonah. And in Jonah's case, he's fleeing from going to the Gentiles. In Yeshua's case, he's journeying to the land of the Gentiles because there's a Gentile man he must encounter. They both encounter a storm at sea. In both cases, it says that the occupants of the boat were terrified that they're going to die. But Jonah's asleep in the bottom of the boat, and Yeshua here is asleep in the bottom of the boat. And then when the men wake up Jonah, they ask him, "What have you done?" Because they began to realize he was the cause of the storm. And to Yeshua they ask, "Well, don't you care?" So when they jettison Jonah, there's peace. When they awaken Yeshua, there's peace. And I know of believers, you know, I've probably done this in my own life, where I want to keep rebellion in my life and throw Yeshua out, and I wonder why that's still storming. You can't have Jonah and Yeshua both asleep in your boat. Jonah is a picture of rebellion against God. Yeshua is the very Son of God. He is the Word made flesh. He is obedience to God. And you got to get rid of one or the other. Make sure you throw out the right one. Throw rebellion out of the boat. Awaken Yeshua. But if you throw Yeshua out of the boat, you will awaken rebellion. Make sure you get the right guy out of the boat. All right? And I have met people over and over and over, believers, people who know the word. And they're harboring rebellion in their lives and wondering why their lives are a mess. It's like, quit rebelling against God. Obey Him. Quit doing things your own way. Do things His way. But no, they'll throw Yeshua out every time and hang on to Yonah. Yes, Steve, I see your hand up. Go right ahead. Sure. Yeah. Yes. Yes, this was these were experienced fishermen, so this had to be quite the storm, right? That's the tough thing. People who are loners have a hard time seeing that. You know, going back up here, I didn't take time to look at it closely, but the people God calls, first of all, are people who are productive. They're occupied in doing their work. Second of all, they're in pairs. They know how to cooperate with others. There are no lone rangers. God just doesn't use lone rangers. Now, with the one exception, with a genuine prophet. Genuine prophets tend to be lone rangers, but they're the only ones. But whenever you meet a lone ranger, a person who wants to serve God all on their own, just be God's man, and they just can't find anyone else worthy of their fellowship, they're not a prophet. They're not a prophet. And oftentimes, these are the troublemakers. But you must find people who are in communion with other people, who know how to live in peace with other people, to work shoulder to shoulder, because after all, Yeshua wants you to take His yoke upon you and work shoulder to shoulder with Him. How can you work with Him if you can't work with one another? And they're productive. They're busy. They're going about their lives. They're doing things with their hands. They're taking care of the daily, ordinary things of life. They're involved in earning a living. They're not just sitting around waiting for something spiritual to happen. One other thing, too. We don't have a name for this scribe, but we don't have a name for this so-called disciple. Because it's only the people who truly follow God with all their hearts and souls and strength who earn a name. In this world, to get a name, you have to do some bizarre thing in sports or acting or make money or whatever. But in God's economy, you serve Him. You're sold out to Him completely. No one in this world may know who you are, but your name is written with Him. And you've got a name that lasts for eternity, a new name. And there are a lot of lessons right here in this one frame here with Matthew 4 and Matthew 8. I hope if nothing else, I'm stirring up your curiosity, interest to go over and look at these and really lay them out and analyze them more on your own. Well, let's get back to our storm. Thank you, Steve. Those are very insightful remarks. And anyone else who has anything to share or question, please don't hesitate. There is one other storm that we have to look at. We'll be looking at it again later. But that's the storm in Matthew 14. If you want to look at Matthew 14, you can read along with me. It's in verses 22 to 33. Now, with the two storms we've looked at, the Jonah storm and then the storm where Yeshua is asleep in the boat, keep this storm in mind. Matthew 14, 22. Then Yeshua urged His disciples to go down into the boat to cross ahead of Him to the other side of the sea until He had sent away the people. This time, Yeshua is not in the boat at all. But once again, He's dispersing the crowd. He sent the people away and went up the mountain alone to pray. It was evening. He was there alone. Now the boat had come halfway across the sea, and the waves were tearing it apart, for there was a wind against it. During the fourth watch, Yeshua came to them, walking on the surface of the water. His disciples saw Him walking on the surface of the sea and were terrified. As if they're not afraid enough already, now they're terrified. They said, "It is the appearance of a spirit. It's a ghost." and they cried out in fright. Yeshua quickly called to them, "Be strong, for it is I. Do not fear." Peter answered and said to him, "If it is you, Master, please command, and I will come to you on the water." He said, "Come." And Peter went down from the boat and walked on the surface of the water to come to Yeshua. When he saw that the wind was strong, he became afraid, began to sink, and he cried out and said, "Master, save me." Yeshua quickly reached out his hand, took hold of him, and said to him, "Small one in faith, why is your heart divided?" In other words, "I've already calmed one storm. Don't you remember?" They went up into the boat, and the wind subsided. Then the men in the boat approached and bowed down to him and said, "Surely you are the Son of God." Now remember what they said the first time? "What kind of man is this that even the winds and the waves obey him?" This time, they knew. They bow down and say, "Surely you are the Son of God." Now, what's the difference between this storm and the previous one? Yeshua is asleep in the boat before. He's not even in the boat this time. We'll look at this more when we get to chapter 14 later down the road. But I think one of the things God wants to teach us is this. He cares about us. And he's much more devoted to us than we are to him. He cares much more for us than we care for him. He loves us much more than we love him. And yet we say, "Don't you care?" And it's, "Yes, I do." And even when he seems to be completely and totally absent, he's absolutely aware. And he will come in his own way, in his own time, in a totally unexpected way. Before he violated the laws of nature by just saying the word and everything got quiet, this time he violates them even more by walking on the water and then inviting Peter to do the same. Before he showed his control over the elements, but this time he goes even way beyond that. That even the storm itself is not a danger. And he just takes a nice leisurely stroll across the waves in the middle of the storm. And Peter says, "Can I do that?" "Sure, come on." And he does. I think he's trying to graduate the disciples and us to realizing, when there's a storm in life, wake me up. Don't be afraid, though. Wake me up. Get me up. Stir me up. Appeal to me. That's what we do. We cry out to him, and he helps us. But I think he wants to graduate on to the point where he realizes you too have nothing to fear from the storm. And you too can walk on the water in the midst of it. You can go far beyond what you think you can endure. You can go far beyond what you think is going to destroy you. And nothing can touch you unless I give it permission. And if I give it permission, it's for your good. But in all cases, fear is illegal. You are not allowed to be afraid of anything except him. You never fear the storm around you. The waves, the wind, the noise, you are not permitted to be afraid. And to be afraid is sin. So turn it off. Turn it off. That's the lesson I think he's trying to teach us here. But boy, is it a hard one to learn. We think, "Yeah, I got it. And the storm comes, we just fall to pieces again. And they, I've got it. Okay, God says, "I'm going to send a storm." Okay, ready. Storm comes, we're all going to die. You know, and it's like, all right, I'm going to get it this time. And the storms will keep coming because there are teachers. There are teachers. And eventually we've got to get it. We have to grasp this fact if we really want to be mighty in spirit, if we really want to be mature disciples of Messiah. Mim, I saw your hand up. Yes. Yes.
And we need to remember that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why
to realize that God runs the world, he's in absolute total control, and he loves us with all his heart, then anything we see and we perceive as being destructive to us is a fantasy. It's an illusion. Because he has our best interest at heart all the time. And so he's testing the limits of how much we trust him. That's what he's doing. And it's not to ridicule us and to reduce us, but to strengthen us to where we can be in the boat with a storm all around. We can't find Yeshua anywhere, and we laugh at it because we know that he's in control. You know, Robin and some of the ladies have been studying Proverbs 31, the woman of valor. And the one phrase that keeps going through my mind all the time in that study, it says, strength and dignity are her clothing. And she smiles at the future. One translation, but she laughs at the future. And yet it seems to be the future that terrifies us. But we are to clothe ourselves as the bride of Messiah, to clothe ourselves in strength and in dignity. Dignity means fearlessness. A dignified person doesn't show fear. They're not uppity and huffy and everything. They're just dignified. They walk as people who are in perfect peace. They don't have to prove anything, but there's no fear. Strength and dignity are our clothing. Is that what you're clothed in? Strength and dignity? Or you continue to crumble to pieces and lose your dignity? Is your life an embarrassment or an inspiration? And if we walk and clothe ourselves in strength and dignity, we smile at the future. We laugh at the future because we know the end of the story. And we know that that's reality. And what appears to be a storm around us, we know who runs the world. Well, Yeshua encountered two men who wanted to be his followers, but there was instability within them. And then he deals with his own disciples and the instability of the world around him. But now he's going to come into a real storm, and we pick it up in verse 28. It says, when he came to the other side of the sea, to the land of Gadarim, or Gergeshim, or Gerashim, or Gadarene, we don't know what to call this place. Different manuscripts all use different names, and people are always trying to figure out exactly where this is. May I suggest it just doesn't really matter? Anyway, it says, two men who were gripped by demons met him as they were coming out from the tombs. Now, in Mark and Luke, it mentions one demoniac. Here it mentions two. Matthew has this way of putting a lot of things in pairs that other Gospels only mention one of. For example, when Martin read from Matthew 21 this morning, in Matthew, Yeshua sends his disciples to get the donkey, right, for him to ride into Jerusalem on. But he says, you'll find two, a donkey and its colt, bring them. And he says, and he rode on them, on two. And there are other examples in Matthew where there are pairs of things where the other Gospels only mention one of something. I'm not sure why this is, but that's something for you to wrestle with in the meantime. But even though there are two men to come out, apparently there's only one who is delivered. And that's what the other Gospels are referring to. There's only one here who responded and wanted to be rid of these demons. So anyways, it says they ran out of the tombs, and they were so belligerent that no one was able to cross that road. They were screaming, saying, what do we have to do with you, Yeshua, Son of God? Have you come here to afflict us before the time or when it is not time? The demonic realizes, and we'll talk about the demonic in chapter 12. That's the chapter, if you want to understand the demonic, that's the chapter of the Bible you go to, Matthew chapter 12. And so it's just a few chapters down the road. We'll talk about the demonic. We'll have a big crowd here that week too. And we'll talk about the demonic that week. But suffice it to say that the demonic are aware of their surroundings, they're aware of what's going on, and they realize, being in the spiritual realm, they realize there is a day of accounting coming when they must also be subjected to the refiner's fire. And they dread that day. It says, there was a herd of many pigs there, grazing at a distance from them. The demons begged him, saying, if you drive us out, let us enter the herd of pigs. One of the things I'll say about the demonic, they crave physical sensation. They crave to be in a host. I think it's one of the things that makes them demonic, is because they are so addicted to spiritual or physical stimulation and physical appetites. In fact, in some cases where I've been involved in deliverance, we would ask the demon its name. It would say something like nicotine or alcohol or drugs or lust. In other words, when they give it their name, they're given the very essence of what they are, what their appetite is. And they're identifying themselves. So demons crave some kind of sensual experience that can only be achieved through being in a physical host, even if it's an animal. So they said, let us go into the pigs. Now, a couple questions here. First of all, why were there pigs there? Well, the area of Galilee was the land of the Gentiles. You know, in the prophecy, it says how a great light has shone in the Galilee, the land of the Gentiles. Up in the Galilee, you had Jews and Gentiles living next to each other, because so many of the Gentiles immigrated to Israel came to the Galilee, which is very green, very beautiful, great farmland. In the south, it's desert, but up in the north, it's just beautiful. They settled there. It's a great place to live. Then over on the east side of the Sea of Galilee is called the Decapolis, which means the 10 cities. And these are 10 Gentile cities. So it's predominantly Gentile over there, and so pigs would have been a common thing. Now, it wouldn't be a little unusual, but you would also find pigs in other places because pigs were created by God to eat the droppings. They were created to eat the garbage. They are the land equivalent of oysters and clams and lobsters and crabs. They eat the stuff that falls to the bottom. They keep the water pure, and the pigs keep the land clean. That's what they do. Okay? If you live in a village where there's no plumbing, you won't find any droppings on the ground. The pigs eat them. They just eat it all. That was what God created them for, to keep the landscape clean. This is why they are not to be food. Another thing, too, pig meat tastes like human flesh. Now, I haven't tasted human flesh, but I've read accounts of people who have. And they don't say it tastes like chicken. They say it tastes like pork and smells like pork. There's something about the pig that God, it's an abomination, he says, for a person to eat the flesh of a pig. And we're not to eat it. It's not food. I don't care how good it tastes and how good it smells. According to God, it is not food. And so, to release the demons into the pigs, well, the pigs are just doing their job. They're taking the uncleanness and the filth from the world and absorbing it into themselves. That's what they're created for. So what's more perfect than to have these pigs there to absorb these demons? Now, whether the demons realize or not, these pigs would all then commit suicide, I don't know. But one of the things we'll learn later is that demons do, they are attracted to water. They are attracted to water. Yeshua will talk later how they travel through dry places looking for a place to rest. They don't like dry places. They like to be near water. That's another reason why the Jewish people traditionally have seen the ocean and the sea as being hell. Okay? And we'll get into that a lot more later on. So they said, if you drive us out, let us enter the herd of pigs. He said, go. That's what they're created for. They came out and entered the herd of pigs, and the entire herd of pigs rushed down the slope into the sea, and they died in the water. Can you imagine seeing hundreds, maybe thousands of corpses of pigs floating in the lake? And then when Yeshua and the disciples leave, they're rowing, and there's pig bodies floating around. That'd been an ugly scene. Well, the herders for the pigs, the herders fled. They came to the town and told about everything that had happened to the men gripped by demons. Then the entire town went out to meet Yeshua. And when they saw him, they requested that he leave their region. Go away. Isn't that something? Go away. They didn't care that the men had demons in them, but once they get into their pigs, now this is serious. We tend to be the same way. We can have a neighbor who has issues in their lives. We don't care about that. But as soon as we get a little bit of an issue in our house, it's like, oh, no, this is important. We tend to be much the same way. But now there's a passage Mark and Luke bring out. We'll go to Luke 8:38. Luke continues the story a little bit and tells us about what happened with these who were delivered. It says in Luke 8:38, the man from whom the demons had gone begged that he might be with him. Now, remember the beginning of our story today? Two men are asking Yeshua if they can follow him, and he kind of, no, you're not ready to follow me. Now we have a man at the end of the story who also is requesting to follow Yeshua. But Yeshua sent him away, saying, return to your home and declare how much God has done for you. Now think of all the times where Yeshua would work a miracle and they say, shh, don't tell anybody. Don't tell anybody, be quiet. But with this man, he says, you go home, you tell everybody what God's done for you. What's the difference? Main difference is, this is a Gentile. And Yeshua says, I'm not coming to the land of the Gentiles yet. I'm sending you in my place. By this man following Yeshua would not have accomplished as much as Yeshua saying, no, you carry me to them. That's a powerful thing. It's an amazing thing that he's done. And he went, proclaiming throughout the whole city how much Yeshua had done for him. I guess you could say this man is the first missionary to the Gentiles. Isn't that amazing? It's just an amazing thing. And if you want to create another menorah pattern, think of another time where Yeshua took a little side trip to talk to one Gentile outcast. What would that be? Woman at the well, John chapter 4. So he goes to talk to this Gentile woman who's an outcast because of her morality. Here he goes to talk to a male outcast who lives in the tombs because of his demonic possession. And yet they both take the gospel to the town they're in. It's an amazing story. So you can take those two, lay those two stories side by side. And you're going to see the similarities and the opposites as well. Yes, Jim. Yes.
And they ran over the cliff. The demons wanted to get a body, like they like to live in a body.
Right.
Was it their prompting that ran over the cliff?
Well, that's the question. Was it this the pig's idea or the demon's idea to go jump in the sea? Or a little bit of both? I don't know. I don't know. Well, but I've got a few weeks to think about it before we get to chapter 12. I'm going to talk about it more then. But I invite you, if you all have insights and you study this out, you might have... yes, Rob. Yeah. They went somewhere else, obviously. Yeah, they look for another host. Yeah. Yeah, you don't drown a demon. Yeah. So, yes, Tony.
Mm-hmm. Then he wasn't in the boat, but when they called, when they were full of fear, he came. This is the same message he is with this person that he got rid of the demons from. Yeah. It wasn't that he was saying, now go on your own. Yeah. He's still going to be with them, and we have to understand that Christ is always with us
yeah.
in the spirit and that power. message that Christ is saying, even my disciples, when I physically water them, they still stumble, they still, and then when he wasn't, and they he was there.
Yes. Good point. And you know, while you're talking, Tony, I'm thinking too, if this man had not been possessed by these demons, he would not have been as rich and large a vessel to carry the spirit of Yeshua and the message of Yeshua to the Gentiles. And people who have been seriously demon-possessed and delivered, it's all of a sudden, it's like the demonic has stretched their capacity for the spiritual. They are very aware of the spiritual realm. You don't have to convince them about the spiritual realm, the reality of God and the enemy and all that. They know it. But boy, when they are delivered and then God's spirit comes into them, it's like a 10 times the portion most people get.
Are you using any of those?
No, not at all. not at all. Yes, Walt. Yes. Well, let me just say this to you and any other pork eaters and hearing. You'll never hear one word of condemnation come from me or the other people in this congregation who don't eat pork. You'll never hear a word of condemnation to us. We're no one's judge, and we're not the pork police. We just... good. You don't need to worry about it. But I just want you to say that I'm not teaching these things because we're trying to... I just want to teach the truth. And, you know, you and I were both raised in a tradition that said, well, God's commandments are done away with.